Reading is from Daniel chapter 1, verses 3 to 21. That's on page 891 of the Church Bibles. Then the king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace, and to teach them the literature and the language of the Chaldeans. The king assigned them a daily portion of the food that the king ate and of the wine that he drank. They were to be educated for 3 years, and at the end of that time they were to stand before the king. Among these were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah of the tribe of Judah. And the chief of the eunuchs gave them names. Daniel he called Belteshazzar, Hananiah he called Shadrach, Mishael he called Meshach, and Azariah he called Abednego. But Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food, or with the wine that he drank. Therefore he asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. And God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, I fear my lord the king who assigned your food and your drink. For why should he see that you are in worse condition than the youths who are of your own age? So you would endanger my head with the king. Then Daniel said to the steward whom the chief of the eunuchs had assigned over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, test your servants for 10 days. Let us be given vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance and the appearance of the youths who eat the king's food be observed by you, and deal with your servants according to what you see. So he listened to them in this matter and tested them for 10 days. At the end of 10 days, it was seen that they were better in appearance and fatter in flesh than all the youths who ate the king's food. So the steward took away their food and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables. As for these 4 youths, God gave them learning and skill in all literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. At the end of the time, when the king had commanded that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar, and the king spoke with them. And among all of them, none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore they stood before the king. And in every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters that were in all his kingdom. And Daniel was there until the first year of King Cyrus.
Okay. I don't know if you've come across this book, The Screwtape Letters. I read it as a teenager. It's by C.S. Lewis. It's quite an interesting book. It's a bunch of letters from a senior demon or devil to a junior demon. And the point of it is they're discussing strategies for ensnaring and enslaving believers and trying to get, or people in general, trying to send them to hell, which is actually a better, more uplifting and encouraging book than it sounds. It sounds pretty heavy. And it's a great book, not least because it alerts us as we read it to spiritual dangers, which are actually not the sorts of dangers you and I are most conscious of in day-to-day life. For example, one danger in the book is just living a normal life, you know, a normal life of non-spectacular, common or garden rebellion against God, just fitting in with everyone else. And this senior demon, Screwtape, he writes to the junior one and he says this, "You will say that these are very small sins, and doubtless, like all young tempters, you are anxious to be able to report spectacular wickedness. It does not matter how small the sins are, provided that their cumulative effect is to edge the man away from the light and out into the nothing. Indeed, the safest road to hell is the gradual one, the gentle slope, soft underfoot, without sudden turnings, without milestones, without signposts." Now, I guess for a lot of people, a normal life of non-spectacular rebellion against God might not seem particularly dangerous. But I think Lewis is onto something, because according to the Bible, that is absolutely deadly for human beings. I used to meet up with someone regularly, and we used to have this kind of formula of questions we'd ask each other. And one of the questions was this. If the devil wanted to take down Andrew Latimer, what do you think he would do at the moment to do that? And we'd ask each other that question. It's a great question to ask of ourselves and of other people, because it forces us to think, what are the particular dangers for us at the moment spiritually? I think sometimes the enemy, he tries to take down an individual or a church by force, by persecution. And later in this book of Daniel, as we're going to read on, there's going to be crisis moments where God's people have to choose in a moment between faithfulness to God or a raging fire or ravaging lions. And that danger, when it happens, you know, it's got a big red warning sign on it. It's obvious what the issue is. But other times, and this is what we're going to be looking at here in chapter 1, the threat is a lot more subtle. It's a bit like if you're sailing or on a boat and there's rocks submerged under the surface, but they're equally able to shipwreck us. And the threat that Daniel and his friends are facing in our chapter today is the threat of fitting in. Doesn't sound very dangerous. So let's look at point one there. When the culture wants to gobble you up, and when it says, don't stick out. Now, last week, or 2 weeks ago, actually, if you were here, we looked at Daniel and his friends getting deported, exiled, away from their homeland in Judah to this foreign kingdom of Babylon. And Nebuchadnezzar, the king, he's a very intelligent guy. He knows that conquest is not enough. If he wants to rule over a people, he needs not just conquest, but conversion. He needs to switch people to Babylonian thinking. Hearts and minds, as we say today, are the key. In the 1960s and 70s, the US put huge resources into trying to resist the spread of communism from North Vietnam down into South Vietnam, and it went very badly. But I'm told, and I haven't done this, maybe somebody has and can update us, but if you visit North Vietnam today, in terms of this conflict between capitalism and communism, McDonald's and Coca-Cola are succeeding where the B-52 bombers failed. You know, so they've won, not through conquest, but through conversion to capitalism. And so this guy Nebuchadnezzar, what he does is it's what the British Raj did much later in history, where he took the brightest and the best and you educate them with your values and then you send them back to rule for you. And Daniel and his friends are in this hand-picked elite group. They're given imperial sponsorship, verse 5, to do a 3-year MBA. That is a master's in Babylonian administration. They're young men, so they're not kind of steeped in, they're not set in the religion of their forefathers. And then they're immersed, verse 4, in the literature and language of the Chaldeans, that's the Babylonians. Now this is very significant there in verse 4. These young men are not just being told a few Babylonian phrases, which might be useful, and a few skills for administration. We read there that they're being taught Babylonian literature. And behind all literature and TV and music lies a worldview, a way of looking at the world which assumes certain things about why we're here. What's the problem with the world? What will put it right? What's truly valuable? And so on. And so everything we read, everything we hear, we watch is communicating a worldview to us. Now, where would you say that we as a society get our values and our attitudes from? You know, our attitudes to family life or to crime and punishment or to revenge and forgiveness or to sexual ethics or to drugs or to race or HIV or whatever it is. I don't think it's just literature in the classical sense that sets the culture. Polly Toynbee, who's a journalist, she was writing in The Independent a while back, and she put it like this. There was a time, looking back, when sociologists were the gurus and the priests of our culture to whom we looked for guidance, but not now. Who holds our hands and leads us through the dark maze of society, illuminating how we live, what we think, and who we are? And her answer? The soaps. The soap operas, she says, have become our national parables, the stories through which we debate the way we live now. They are our preachers. Now, I don't know what you think about that, whether you agree or not, about soaps in particular. And I think today it's just as likely to be reality TV or blogs or box sets or whatever it is. But I think that she's onto something about how these media set the worldview of our culture. And one of the ways that they do this is in the way they communicate the boundaries of normality. So our culture is constantly feeding us a particular view of the world, of what is the normal attitude that modern people should have. And of course, none of us likes to be thought weird or odd or abnormal. And particularly, we don't like to be those who are condemning those that others say are okay. And so we adopt whatever these new boundaries of normality are. We had some friends over recently, and we're only just getting to know them. And they told us about this fundamentalist church that they'd been to. And they told us that when they went to this church, that the people there, they believed that Christianity was right, every other religion was wrong and condemned to hell. And as they're speaking, I was thinking, this sounds very close, although slightly differently phrased, to the teaching of Jesus. And so inside, as they were talking, you know, I just really wanted to shrivel up. And I was hoping that my facial expression wouldn't betray my own position on it, of what I really believe. Because it's very strong, isn't it? We don't want to stick out from what our culture's worldview is. But for Daniel and his friends, there was something which made this general temptation to breathe in the values of the world around us, made this temptation even more intense. Think about it from their point of view. These guys were the chosen few. You know, if they kept their heads down, there was every chance, you know, if they did what they were told, they could come out of this very, very well. So the hopes of their family, in fact, possibly the hopes of the whole nation, were resting on them. It's very, very powerful and flattering, isn't it? If a senior person comes up to you, puts their hand on your shoulder and says, "Do you know, I think you could go far here." And they don't then add the extra line, but it's kind of assumed. The unspoken next line is, "You could do very well here if you toe the line, if you make sure that your faith stays in the private sphere." I was talking to someone on the wharf recently who's just got promoted. And he described how he could feel immediately that how much harder it was now he's promoted, to be distinctively Christian, because the company's expectations on him to live a certain way and to act in a certain way had actually increased. And also he actually felt that he now had much more to lose. Now, nothing had actually been said to him out loud, but he just knew that this temptation to conform had just switched up a notch. There's a point near the beginning of Jesus' ministry where the devil says to him, "To you I will give all the kingdoms of this world if you will just bow the knee to me." Now, there's no big threats in that, are there? Just an offer. Just an attractive, tantalizing offer. One Christian writer, he put it like this: "We scarcely know how to turn our backs on admiration, yet a kick from the world does believers less harm than a kiss." So later on in Daniel, and we're going to read through later, there will be the kicks of raging fires and ravaging lions. But right now, the biggest danger for Daniel and his friends, and probably the biggest danger for you and for me, is a kiss from the world. Do you know, you could be on the inside. You could be someone. So what are they to do? Well, the answer is, when the culture wants to gobble you up, make sure, point two, that you don't gobble it up. So these Jews, they're inside Babylon, but the big question is, will Babylon get inside them? If you and I are immersed in deep water and we're completely surrounded by it, Here's a little tip for free. The main thing you mustn't do is to open your mouths and let it all inside. You know, what we take in will determine whether we survive or not spiritually. And the first thing Daniel shows us, and that's there on the sheets, is that you and I need to think carefully. Until verse 8, Daniel has been pretty passive, but in verse 8 we read this: "But Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank." So Daniel is drawing a line. He's not going to gobble up everything that's put before him. But what exactly is this line he's drawing? What's the issue? Well, I think it'd be helpful for us before we look at that exactly is to take a step back and to consider this whole issue of line drawing more broadly. The first exiles settled outside the city of Babylon by the Kibar River. And some prophets of the day, they rose up, people like Hananiah, and we read about him in Jeremiah 28. And he was saying, look, God is about to judge Babylon, and he's going to put us back in charge. So whatever you do, don't move into the city. Stay separate. But the prophet Jeremiah, back in Jerusalem, he wrote a letter to the exiles which revealed the true will of God. And this letter, which we find in Jeremiah 29, in this letter he effectively says, being gobbled up by the city or separating from the city are not the only two options. What God wants is for us to stay in covenant relationship with him, not losing our identity, but that doesn't mean separating from the city, but rather he wants us to invest in the city, seek the city's welfare, pray for it. So don't forget God and love the city, or forget the city and love God. Love both. That's Jeremiah's letter. And this principle from Jeremiah's letter seems to be the blueprint for Daniel's life. Which is why in this chapter we see him, don't we, taking on this Babylonian education and serving the Babylonian government and even taking on a Babylonian name. So he's not separating off, he's engaging with the society in which God has placed him. But as he does so, he also needs to maintain his distinct identity as one of God's people. And of course that is going to mean drawing some lines. So there's the question. Why does he draw the line on this issue? Why doesn't he want to consume the food and wine in verse 8? Well, I don't think the issue is a kosher issue. It doesn't seem to be that God's law forbade this diet, because there's no kosher laws in the Bible about wine. So I don't think it's that. The issue doesn't seem to be about whether the food had been sacrificed to pagan gods, because I think that would have been the case as with the vegetables as well, and Daniel doesn't have any problem with eating the vegetables. So the best clue as to what is going on here, I think, comes from chapter 11, verse 26, where we're told about a king who will be betrayed, it says, even by those who eat the king's food. It's a little clue that eating at the king's table in those days is a symbol of being an intimate, close, covenantal relationship with the king. And so what Daniel's doing is he's saying, look, I will take the education. I'll even take this new name you're going to give me. But you do not own me. I belong to another. And I'm going to make that clear on this issue. Now, it's interesting, isn't it, that this is the issue for Daniel. I think it would have been nice for Daniel if it had been something more obvious, you know, like in chapter 3. To work here, you need to bow down to that golden statue. You know, if it was, the kind of red light would start flashing. That's against the Ten Commandments. I know I'm not meant to do that. But very often in life, drawing the line is not that easy. And it requires us to think carefully. If you were here for the Jeremy Marshall event last month, he's a bank chief executive, and he was interviewed and spoke here. And in one of the interviews, he explained that only once in his professional career had he been asked to do something which he considered clearly immoral. But he said lots of times it was very subtle and incremental. What he's being asked to do is actually not very different from what he was asked to do last time. But actually, as he thinks about it and as he analyzes it, he sees that this time he is crossing a line and that he needs to make a stand on this one. So let's say, I mean, there'll be all kinds of careers and jobs represented here, but let's say you work as an actor, which at least somebody does. You know, what kind of roles should a Christian actor take? Where would you draw the line? Now, I think if we never ask that question, you know, how does the cross and resurrection, how do the big themes of the Christian life and the gospel, how do they influence how I do my acting, for example? If we never ask that question, then it's very likely we're in the process of being gobbled up. But answering that question is not straightforward. So, you know, if you check at the end of the Bible, that there isn't an appendix on which acting jobs Christians can take. Now, of course, the Bible does have some very basic rules on the topic, but not very many. And I guess some of us feel that is a bit frustrating. Perhaps, really, we like being children. We want an authoritative church that tells us exactly what to do. You know, we want, perhaps especially in this area of guidance, we want to be spoon-fed so that we don't have to pray, we don't have to think about it. Or perhaps we like that so that we can then chafe against the rules and conclude how unreasonable they are. But actually, God wants something very different. He wants you and me to grow up. He wants us to be adults spiritually and to pray and to think carefully. Now, one thing that this means is that you and I need each other. And especially we need to hook up with people in similar situations to our own. Perhaps similar life stages, or perhaps people in our particular industry, so that we can help each other think through these issues carefully. For another thing, it means you and I will need to be generous-spirited. You know, different godly, spirit-filled Christians are going to draw different lines. In the 1924 Olympics, famously, Eric Liddell, he pulled out of the 100 metres because that would have meant running on a Sunday, and he wasn't prepared to do it. But perhaps some of us here, we wouldn't draw exactly the line that he did draw. But we can still admire and support those Christians who draw different lines from us. Someone at my old church used to work, still does work, for one of the Magic Circle law firms in the city, which involves, for him, working very, very long hours. And he decided that for him, the line which showed that he was owned by God and not by the firm was that he would always make it to home group on a Tuesday night. And often, and that meant going back to the office after group, which is very costly for him. And I know that the temptation for him was then to look down his nose at other Christian colleagues who drew the line in different places from where he did. But the point for all of us is that we need to think carefully and prayerfully, and then we need to draw the line somewhere. As someone has said, if you're sliding down an ice floe, more important than where you put the ice axe in, you know, whether you put it here or here, is that you've got to put it in somewhere. Otherwise, you'll fall off the edge of the cliff. Now, I know that was a big point, bigger than the gap, if you're taking notes. But it's an important one. So next, we see the importance of starting early. Starting early. Perhaps you've thought to yourself in the past, you know, I would love to have a big Christian influence in my situation. But realistically, I could be most effective if I were able to rise up to the top of my profession first or get firmly established in that friendship group first. Then I'll start nailing my colours to the mast. But actually, that is very dangerous thinking. You know, like my friend on the wharf who just got promoted, it gets harder and not easier to stand for Christ. And then we have more and more to lose. Or perhaps for some here, we read Christian biographies about martyrs, and we dream one day of being like Daniel in this book, being prepared to be thrown into the lion's den rather than being disloyal to God. But how do you and I become a Daniel in that situation, who incidentally, unlike the pictures in our children's Bible, was probably in his 80s when he made that stand. And the answer is, we need to start early. So this chapter, chapter 1, is about 65 years before the Lion's Den episode. And the way we grow into the type of people who are ready to be radically sacrificial in our faithfulness to God is that we start being faithful in smaller ways today. You know, if we're starting a new job or if we're being thrown into a new group of people, pray for a chance to be public about your faith as early as possible. That is how you and I grow in this area and become people of faithfulness. Next, there on the sheets, proceed wisely. Now, I've only just noticed this this week, but as far as this story is concerned, it would still make sense, wouldn't it, if we jumped from the end of verse 8, therefore he asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself, that's Daniel. We could jump, couldn't we, straight from there to verse 16. So the steward took away their food and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables. But in between these verses, there's a whole section detailing how Daniel skillfully negotiates this situation. Initially, of course, the situation doesn't look promising because this guy, the chief of the eunuchs, he's afraid for his own life, verse 10, if he permits Daniel's request. But Daniel is skillful. He approaches the steward and he comes up with this proposal of a 10-day trial, which is a way of helping his seniors to get on board with his proposal without them taking so much risk on themselves. I was in a small group meeting here on the barge this week, a lunchtime one, and somebody in the group was explaining how they're in a situation where what their boss was asking for of them, it wasn't necessarily wrong, but they could tell it wasn't really serving the client. And this person was asking our group what we thought she should do. And we looked at these verses together, and they're very helpful because they show how faithfulness, you know, when something's not a clear-cut issue, it means, we see here, not being awkward, not being obstructive, but starting a conversation, trying to think of creative ways which might help our boss get on board with what we're proposing. I heard recently about a Christian executive and his company were about to do a deal with another company. I won't tell you exactly the company, but he was convinced that this company, what they were doing was unhelpful and pretty destructive to society. So what he did is he did everything he could to oppose the deal at the board level, but he lost the vote because the others could see it was very profitable. So what should he do in that situation? Difficult question. I mean, he could do nothing. He could just fit in, toe the line. Or I suppose he could quit the firm, you know, separate from his colleagues. But what he did was he told the board that since they'd voted for it, he would work as hard as anyone else to secure that deal. But once the deal was made, he wanted no personal benefit from it. He wouldn't take a share in the bonus that the rest of them would divide up. Now, what do you think his colleagues think of him? That he's just like one of them? No. That he's very awkward and difficult and judgmental? No. That he's mad? Well, possibly. But it does mean that next time a situation comes up, they will listen to him in a very different way. And already he spoke about how it's given him opportunities to speak of his faith. So yes, we're to draw lines, but we're to proceed wisely, not being as awkward and as objectionable as we can be. And finally, I've put on the sheets there, act corporately. Now it's interesting that until Daniel takes a stand in verse 8, no one else does. But when he does, God gives him three friends to stand with him. Now I guess sometimes we will have to stand alone. When I say alone, God will stand with us in that situation. But very often the answer in the Bible to ungodly peer pressure is not being a solitary hero, you know, me against the world, which is very, very difficult. But as we're able to, gathering together with like-minded folk and standing together. You would love to stand clearly for Jesus in your situation, in the classroom, in the office, wherever it is. But it seems so hard. Well, why not pray for and seek out an ally, a friend or two, whom you can pray with, whom you can encourage, and who you can stand together with? So this passage has shown us that when the culture wants to gobble us up, we must be careful not to gobble it up. We must draw a line. And this chapter ends with a wonderful encouragement to help us do that. So I've put there, because God honours those who honour him. Let me read from verse 17. As for these four youths, God gave them learning and skill in all literature and wisdom. And Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. At the end of the time, when the king had commanded that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar, and the king spoke with them. And among all of them, none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore they stood before the king. And in every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters that were in all his kingdom. So this chapter began, didn't it, with these youths plunged into this foreign environment, far from home. And the chapter ends with them being equipped by God and then raised up and honoured. And the hinge, the turning point, it all happens as the Lord enables them to maintain their faithfulness. And one of the questions Jeremy Marshall was asked when he was here was, is it still possible to get to the top of your career if you're faithful to God? And I guess the answer from Daniel and his friends, and the answer from Joseph being raised up to rule Egypt in the book of Genesis, is yes. Yes, it is possible. But in some ways, I think that might be the wrong question, because faithfulness also leads Daniel into the lion's den. It leads his friends into a fiery furnace. It leads Joseph into a dungeon. So there's nothing automatic about it. But this pattern of God honouring those who honour him is always true, ultimately. As always, this chapter, like the rest of the Bible, always points beyond itself to the one who didn't just find himself immersed in a hostile world, as Daniel did, but who willingly chose to plunge himself into that hostile world out of love. It points to Jesus. He was the one who was always perfectly faithful to God. And even when he was standing before a foreign ruler who had the power of life and death over him, he was faithful to God. And he declared, Pilate, you would have no authority over me at all unless it had been given you from above. And as Jesus died, it was our compromise, our faithlessness that he was paying for. And then God raised him up and honored him and exalted him. And because of Jesus's lifting up, our ultimate lifting up is perfectly secure. Whether or not God raises us up in this world, we know that he will raise us up in the next. The final verse of this chapter, verse 21, says this. And Daniel was there until the first year of King Cyrus. Now, even though this is early days for Daniel, we're only in the first chapter, we know even from chapter 1, how the story is going to end. So when this guy Cyrus, the Persian, invades Babylon, this great empire, which seems so mighty, so intimidating, is going to drop with a thud into the mausoleum of history. But we discover in verse 21 that Daniel, God's servant, is still going to be on his feet. It's a little clue, isn't it? That because of Jesus, you and I can be certain that we will outlast the kingdoms of this age. Think about it. Kingdoms rise, kingdoms fall, and yet God's people will endure. It's quite something. As C.S. Lewis puts it, nations, cultures, arts, civilizations, these are mortal, and their life is to ours as the life of a gnat. Pff, gone. But we will endure. And knowing this, knowing that our ultimate future is secure and glorious, this is what gives us the perspective. This is what gives us the confidence we need to recognize the spiritual danger of being gobbled up, but resolve not to be gobbled up, but instead to stand faithfully for Jesus and to draw the line. I'm going to leave a time of quiet. We've covered a lot, and it'd be good to reflect before God what he's saying to each one of us. There are questions on the back to look at afterwards as well, which you might find helpful in reflecting. And then in a moment, when the musicians start, we will stand and sing together.